Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Peter Maxwell Slattery Show. And today's guest is Rick Osman. How you doing, Rick?
I'm well, thank you. And you?
Good, mate. Good. Thank you for coming on the show. I've been looking into some of your work, and I find it fascinating and groundbreaking. It's just fascinating what's, you know, ancient-wise, what's going on, not just in America, but around the world. For those that do not know of you and what you do, would you like to give us a little bit of background, and then we'll go into some of the work you've been doing?
Oh, sure. Well, let's see. How much background do you want? From high school on, I had a government job for a long time. I worked for the U.S. Navy as a civilian, but that also let me travel a lot, and I got to do side trips, you know, from my official travel to visit some of the sites that I really wanted to see. And subsequently, I wrote a book about it called The Graves of the Golden Bear, Ancient Fortresses and Monuments of the Ohio Valley. And it's basically a compilation of about 40 years of my own research. But I was following in other people's tracks for much of it. And I did find a couple of, I consider them new discoveries that fall in line with the older discoveries and rumors of a line of fortresses across the state of Indiana here in the United States. I found the two that were already archaeologically known, and then I found two more that were not. So that was kind of cool. And you draw a ruler between the two that were known and the two that I found are on the same line. So it really was a straight line.
What were the two that weren't known that you found?
It's one of them I call the East Fork site because it's on the East Fork of the White River in Indiana. And the other one I call the Owl Prairie site, and it's on the West Fork of the White River. So when you draw that line between what is basically Louisville, Kentucky, and a place called Merriam, Indiana, where the two already known fortresses were, these two fall in that line. I wrote an article for Ancient American Magazine back in, I believe it was 2007, and said if anyone knows of a works, particularly a stone wall that fits this description, I gave 8 criteria, or, you know, if it fit 4 or 5 of those criteria, I was certainly wanting to look at it. And one of the readers wrote in, or sent me an email actually, and said, I think you might want to come visit. And I did. And he was correct. He has 6 segmented stone walls, artificial, on his property, 10 acres on a hilltop overlooking a river. It fit so many of the criteria that it was amazing. And it was just about dead center on that line between the two known fortresses.
Now,
so it was pretty amazing. And then from that, I extended to the others.
Can you estimate how old the site is just from the work that you've done?
I can say that it is at least 300 years old. So although that would not be before white settlers on the continent, it would be before white settlers in that area, right, which officially became around 1800. So
that's fascinating. Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit about the other site, the other unknown site that you found?
Yeah, it's on the White River, the West Fork of the White River. It had a number of human bones turn up in farming activities. It had an earthen wall around part of the hill, and then the bluff on the river probably at one time had a stone wall. I can't prove that now because pretty much all of it's gone. Yep. It also had both an historic and an ancient coal mine on that hill. So what? Somebody was mining coal before the white man got here? Well, apparently so, because the local histories talk about they dug the new mine because there was already a mine there. So
that's kind of interesting. It sort of mixes up the history books, doesn't it?
It does. And the other thing is all 4 of those sites in that line had a line of sight communication system, or at least they were capable of having. And it also had spurs going off in many directions. It was a true network, much like a telegraph network, but it used light. And some of the antiquarians from the 19th century and even into the 18th century talked about how many of the Mounds and even some of the living natives at that time discussed the ability to send signals over great distances in a very short amount of time. They weren't sending runners, they were sending signals. Yeah. And it wasn't just smoke. It was sophisticated. And the best description I can give, other than it was Morse code telegraph, was that they used something akin to an Ogham writing system. Mm-hmm. And the flash of a mirror in a certain direction and a certain number of them would be the letter of an alphabet. So whoever devised and used this system had a writing system as well. And it was probably Ogham.
What's fascinating about that too is I wonder what happened to them. Being at this level of sophistication compared to, you know, the other tribes and the other people living in America at that time, you know, makes me wonder just, you know, would make anyone think, I wonder what happened to them in time, whether, you know, they died out natives, or taken over, whatever.
Yeah, the natives actually have several legends about that. And a guy by the name of Dana Olson wrote a book entitled Prince Maddock and the White Indians. And the White Indians is a description by the other Indians, not by Dana Olson. And that description was given to General George Rogers Clark and to General John Sievers, who later became governor of Tennessee. And they both recorded that description as part of a conversation with natives and native elders, chieftains in that case, Chief Tobacco and Chief Cornstalk were the two who gave those accounts. The account that George Rogers Clark received described how the fortress that's at Devil's Backbone, also known as Rose Island or 14 Mile Island, which is 14 miles upstream from the falls on the Ohio, had an emplacement, a fortification, a redoubt, if you will, very militaristic in nature. But those people were such a pain in the ass to the other people around them, to the self-described Black Indians, that they banded together, drove them out of the fortress, and killed them. Just absolutely genocide. And that took place, that genocidal act took place at a place called Sand Island, which is now covered up by the Ohio River and the locks on the Ohio right at the falls, very near the falls. So that description was recorded, I believe the year was 1799. And the place at 14 Mile Island was described by a fort by George Rogers Clark, a general of the U.S. Army in his day. So it wasn't like he didn't know a fort when he saw one. Mm-hmm. And John Sievers described several forts in the southern tier, Georgia, Tennessee, and on both sides of that state line, with the same or very similar characteristics and very same or similar background of who built them and used them and what happened to them.
Look, there are things that have been found. Like in my first book that I wrote called The History of Man, I went into, and it's been covered in Ancient Aliens and other shows, where people with red hair and more teeth than normal and basically giants have been found, the remains in caves that, you know, and then there's Native American stories about these people being there at the time, going back a long time. So this is where little bits of, you know, all this is part of one big puzzle going on, and it's just, you know, I think we're just touching the surface as a collective, unraveling this, what's going on. Would you mind going into your book that you have wrote, and then we'll go into a paper that you've just done lately, recently, which you showed me just before the show, but would you like to go into your book?
Again, the title of my book is The Graves of the Golden Bear, Ancient Fortresses and Monuments of the Ohio Valley. And it is about who was here, but I paid particular attention to what European and other cultures might have visited North America after AD 37, because that matters with regards to land claims. It matters. Mm-hmm. And I go into the entire history of why it matters. There was a 1452 papal bull called Terra Nullius, literally translated from Latin, that would be empty land. And the Pope stated, if you come across a land that is empty of Christians, then you can have the land, and, well, the people aren't Christians, so you can do with them whatever you want. Well, that's what happened in North America. However, there is every indication that Christians from Europe and elsewhere had been here, and that many of the people who were here when Columbus arrived were practicing Christianity. Therefore, the land claim could be null and void. Now, as a practical matter, that's not going to happen. But in the basic rule of law, it would matter. I also had a television show much like this one, and I interviewed a guy by the name of Robert Miller. And Bob is a professor. He teaches law at Lewis and Clark College, Lewis and Clark University in Oregon. And his specialty is land claim law. And he's also Native American extraction. He's Shawnee. And his book or his work is all about what happened. How did we end up in this mess, meaning Native Americans? How did they take all our land? And it was by hook and crook. It was by not following their own laws. But he has also done another book that includes the Aborigines of Australia, and much of the same applies, except that they didn't have any Christianity in their background. It was still taking land that didn't belong to them, or taking rights to land that didn't belong to them. So Robert's work helped me nail down what I think happened for the Native Americans to be displaced and basically ignored. Their history was suppressed and buried and rewritten for them without their consent. And even Thomas Jefferson knew that with particular interest to the Louisiana Purchase, that the United States did not buy the land from France. They bought the rights to trade with the people who owned that land, exclusive trade rights. And it went from bad to worse. So that's the gist of what I wrote about in the first four, five, six chapters. Then I went on to say, and oh, by the way, here's all this evidence of the people who were here before Columbus. Welsh, Romans, Greeks, Carthaginians, Chinese. There are little bits and drabs of evidence everywhere that point to each of those cultures, and the Irish, I forgot the Irish, had been here, in particular Irish monks, so you know they were Christians, although they were not Catholic monks, they were called the monks, which makes a difference to the Catholics, but not to much of anybody else, and not to the land claims under Terra Nullius. Anyway, that's what the book is about. I also have a chapter in there about the giants and the pygmies, because we also have several journal entries and other scientific data regarding very small stature people, kind of like the Flores Island hobbits, very similar in stature and possibly in other aspects. But we don't know because we can't find any of those skeletons here. There is one individual who was approximately 19 inches tall, and his x-rays indicate he was probably 50 to 60 years old. But his body has disappeared. We still have the x-rays.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre. I also make the case that science and archaeology cannot coexist in the same space, because archaeology is not a hard science, and they don't adhere to scientific principles.
Well, yeah. Well, with science, they want you to be able to replicate and get the same outcome each time. And it's a lot like with the paranormal. You just can't do that. And when you work in archaeology, it's a different way you've got to go about it again. Even though you can do scientific testing on artifacts and whatnot, if you can, there's some things you can't exactly do much dating on. Sometimes you can do carbon dating, but if you're looking at things on an atomic scale and that sort of thing, you can get the same results, but not when it goes into the nitty-gritty of what you've gone into. Can you go into some of the artifacts and evidence for other cultures like the Chinese, the Irish, and the Romans being in America before what the American history books say at this time?
Sure. One of the strongest bits, we'll go with the Irish first and kind of work our way backwards. There's a 7th century dated skull from Wyoming County, West Virginia, that is definitely Caucasian. Nearby it, just a few yards away, is a large stone panel with Ogham writing on it in Irish Ogham, Celtic Irish Ogham. And that has been verified, identified, etc., by an Irish Ogham expert who came to West Virginia and said, yep, that's what that is. And the archaeologist who did that work, his name is Robert Pyle, and he was vilified by his peers for even suggesting that, hey, this is real. 5th, 6th century. 6th century in particular, 670 AD or so, is the original Prince Madoc story, Prince Madoc of Wales, who was a half-brother to King Arthur II. And we found, and on the cover of the book is this symbol right here.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Found that symbol over a cave entrance in northeastern Alabama. That is, and the place name is the Welsh Caves. And it's actually a series of 5 caves in the cliffside. That same symbol shows up at Tintagel in Wales, where apparently, or legend has it, that Uther sired Arthur I. It's the same emblem that shows up on a piece of slate from that particular archaeological site in the British Isles. It shows up in a few other places as well, but not with that strong a connection to Arthur. Prince Madoc has long been rumored to have brought a number, thousands of colonists to North America as a result of some event that took place in Wales and really all of the British Isles in 536, I believe it was, on our calendar. But the Cymry calendar has a different starting point. So theirs, it would make our dating of it 570 AD. Uh-huh. So, and then there's also a mural in Drystoke Church in what is basically northeastern England that shows a figure tied to a tree, and he is being pierced by some 20 arrows launched by people who certainly look like Native Americans. Now, a guy by the name of Alan Wilson and his partner Baron Blackett have researched the Cymry / Welsh chronicles going back to the beginning of the 5th century, actually. And Arthur II, according to them, was killed in North America. And his body was put in a cave for 2 years to desiccate. He was sewn into 2 deer skins. And his body desiccated for 2 years before they took him back to Wales. And I think that cave where we found that symbol is where that took place. And then after they got him back to Wales, they kept the body in a second cave for 2 more years because his son was not old enough to take the crown and they didn't trust the regent. So lots of intrigues going on in the 6th century there. Before that, Romans, and we have a collection of some 358, I believe it is, Roman coins have been found along the waterways of North America. Well, a year ago last month, I was in Utah, and up until last year, all of them we knew about were east of the Rockies, east of the Big Mountains. Last year, I found an individual in Spanish Fork, Utah, who has 386 Roman coins he found in one small area west of the Rockies. So it's almost doubled the number. But that's not all. I mean, even these fortresses I'm finding have characteristics that are consistent with the fort building or fortress militarization of sites in Britain and Portugal and North Africa. It's how the did things on some of these forts and the signal towers as well. But the Romans had metals, and there haven't been much metal come out of the mounds or the fortifications or any of these sites. And I really don't know how to justify that. There have been a few metals, mostly just copper, and a few of them appear to be polished plates of copper that would act as a mirror. We know that the British used a special type of lantern to send signals, relay signals over long distances. And we know that in 43 AD, Claudius invaded Britain, sent a signal back to Rome and said, I didn't bring near enough troops, send me another legion. And the date of that message sent is the same date as that message received in Rome from Britain. So they had the capability as well, in a big way, apparently. But they probably got it from the Carthaginians. We know that the Romans mined history. When they conquered someone, they mined their history. In one very specific case, they found a mine, a copper, silver, and gold mine in Spain called Rio Tinto today, where the Carthaginians had mined it for those metals, and the Romans eventually found it and mined those metals themselves. And Rio Tinto is today one of the largest mining concerns in the world. So, mining history. And by the way, the modern company, Rio Tinto, which at its start was a British-based company, found that mine by reading Roman history. So, some things never change.
That's fascinating. Just getting back to the symbol that you have on your book that you found at some of the sites in the States there, do you know the significance or the interpretation or anything about that symbol at all?
I do not. I put it out to a few folks that I trust to give me an honest answer, and they say, we don't know. So it is also associated with the Mormon religion to the extent that Joseph Smith wrote down the full alphabet of what he found in those golden tablets. I don't know. I didn't see those golden tablets, and nobody else can either now, because they apparently were taken back to heaven or whatever. I'm not Mormon. But he did make a list of the characters, and they called them Reformed Egyptian characters. That's how he phrased it. Mm-hmm. And it appears in there. Not exactly like it is on my book. The center leg is not extended in the Reformed Egyptian like it is at the Welsh Cape. It also is not extended at Tintagel. So my simply, I guess, private interpretation, my personal preference more than anything, is that the long leg in the middle is the symbol that Arthur was dead when he was there. Just a guess. Yeah. With nothing really to back it up.
No, it's just funny because the Mormon religion is based upon a book that apparently was given by a Pleiadian to Joseph. And what's funny is I had an experiencer, an ET experiencer in the last week or two actually give me that symbol. So when I find little synchronicities like that, I just go, I don't know. But I'm not saying this has got ET. I just find it very funny that's basically the same symbol that I've been shown recently. Now, you've just worked on another paper. Would you like to go into that document that you showed me before
sure.
the show? And, let us know whatever you would like to tell us about that. Here we go.
Yeah, it's
Fortresses of the Ohio Valley.
Yep. And it's covering new ground. And basically, it's a compilation and a few additions of articles that I've written for Ancient American Magazine over the past year, a little more than a year. And it is, again, a little more material than was actually in the magazine articles. But it covers much of the same ground that I have in the book, but there are new pieces of evidence of which I was not aware when I wrote the book. So rather than put out a second edition or whatnot, I put it into that. And I'm continuing to write articles for Ancient American as well, extending out into plants that are out of place, plants that show up in odd places where they should not be, they should not even survive there, and yet they are there in association with archaeological sites, important archaeological sites. For instance, and this is an upcoming article, it's not even in this compilation yet. The upcoming article, which will be next March, talks a little bit about a plant called Devil's Club, which is found west of the Rockies, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, up into Alaska. And it has all these medicinal properties attributed to it by the Native Americans. And it shows up on Isle Royal and two very small islands near Isle Royal in the middle of Lake Superior. And it's a clone plant. It doesn't grow from seed. So it makes seeds, but it doesn't grow from seed, which is odd by itself. The main point of this whole discussion about Devil's Club is it is considered by the Native Americans as an adaptogen, meaning if you come to visit cold country, you want this because it helps you adapt to the cold. So my contention is whoever transplanted it needed to adapt to the cold of Isle Royal, which, well, right now it's about probably 0 Fahrenheit right up there. It's certainly below freezing on Isle Royal and will be until April. Yeah, you're coming into your summer down there.
Yeah, but yeah, just about to hit
our
it.
Our winter here is I have a dog fight going on in the next room. Our winter here can be quite intense, and Isle Royal is much more intense. It is not well suited to human occupation at all. And yet there were thousands of what they call pit copper mines on Isle Royal before any white settler got there in the 1800s. Probably thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of tons of copper were removed from Isle Royal in prehistoric times.
Is there any idea what this copper was used for? Is there, like, even just any ideas, any theories?
Probably to make bronze. Right. And brass. But the Native Americans used some of it to make their, not just implements, but also ornaments. They had jewelry and, doodads. But they also had knives and spears and arrowheads and plate armor and helmets that had been found in Native American context in mounds. You also have other metals that have been found in mounds. And they were recorded in the antiquarian journals of the 1800s in North America. But after 1881, you never saw a single entry of any metal besides copper.
That's weird.
That's a little weird. you do have what they call half-breeds, which is half silver, half copper, and it came that way. It wasn't poured that way. It wasn't manufactured that way. It just came out of the ground that way. And it's specifically from the Keweenaw Peninsula in Upper Michigan. It just formed that way in nature. And you'll find a few of those in the mound because they were precious. They were priceless. They were weird. It was two different metals that came together. Occasionally, you find a little fleck of gold in it, too. But the native copper that's up there, just on the ground, what's called float copper, was chopped off by a glacier and moved by the glacier to end up wherever it ended up. And you can take a little chunk, and it's pure copper. Occasionally, it's got a little silver in it, but it's more pure than they can even refine at a lot of the advanced metallurgy smelters. Mm-hmm. 99.9 fine in some cases. Nature has some strange habits. Whereas you got the copper ore in, say, Israel, Lebanon, over there, that's, the best stuff in the world, in the old world, was about 15% copper. And it took many, many steps and some excellent, very knowledgeable metallurgists to get it to a usable state, let alone the highly refined state. Mm-hmm. And over here, you can just pick it up off the ground. And there were two other places on the planet where you can find little bits and pieces of what seems to be the same copper, was Nova Scotia in Canada, Eastern Maritimes, and one creek bed in Ireland. They've extracted a few nuggets of extremely pure copper there. No place else in the world does it show up with the same level of purity.
That's interesting.
To get that good of copper today, we have to use electrolysis.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced. convinced that the natives use electrolysis. I'm also not convinced that they did not smelt. The archaeologists said, no, they never smelted any metal. Yet you had the conquistadors in Mexico and Peru reporting brass and bronze and other phosphor bronze. And they knew what they were talking about because they had armorers with them who knew those metals. Mm-hmm. So where did they get them if they didn't make them? Mm-hmm. In about 1000 AD, Peru, Inca, they didn't really call themselves Inca at that time, they changed their taxation system. Up until then, all the taxes had been paid in copper, and they changed to silver for no apparent reason. There's no real reason evident why they did that. But at about that same time in, say, Turkey and Syria, those people figured out how to separate silver from native copper ore. Because it does appear, particularly in German mines. It's just not nearly as high a ratio of content. But they figured out a method exactly that same time to separate the two metals. And the system changed in America. Is there a direct connection? Well, I think there probably is. We just don't know why or the details.
Yeah. Now, I just learnt in time there's no such thing as a coincidence personally myself. So, again, I find that very interesting. What's some of the main things in the work that you've done and the research and the study that you've done and that you've come across that is really taken to you, that have blown your mind? Even, is there anything that you've come across that sort of hasn't really been in the public domain, like any artifacts you've come across that people have kept private and just don't want out there as well? Is there anything like that?
Yes. Well, for one thing, there is a signet ring in a private collection owned by a jeweler, kept in his private collection. He's in Florida. And that signet ring comes from the 9th Legion, Hispania, of the Roman armies. And it has the Roman eagle, the 9th Legion eagle, on that ring. Except in this case, it's a bald eagle. It's a native to America eagle. So that's one thing. Another thing, and he has some of these too, but he's not the only person who owns a bunch of them. A stone sphere, about the size of a tennis ball or slightly smaller. And it's very smooth. It's manufactured. It looks to have been turned on a lathe, and yet it was found in an archaeological context. And he claims, I don't see it, but he claims he can see a signet of the 9th Legion on it. Now, those spears were certainly ammunition for Roman ballista, or at least a spear that size was common ammunition for Roman ballista. They also used bolts, but they also had ballista that would throw a 100-pound ball, and it would throw that a quarter of a mile. That's what they used when they laid siege to Masada in Israel. They threw 100-pound stones a quarter of a mile to the top of that fortress. I'm just talking about smaller ones, but they appear in the archaeological record here by the hundreds. I don't own it. I would love to. A couple of friends of mine have several. And some of them have impact marks where it's hit something really hard, something with an edge on it, like it hit, armor or a weapon of some kind. But there's no way to prove that.
Yeah.
The only way to prove that there were Roman ballista here would be to find Roman ballista or to find Roman records of having been here. And that's not done yet, but I haven't given up. I have a postulate of where those records still exist, but I may not be able to pry them out of that particular repository in Rome.
Yeah, well, you'd probably be referring to the Vatican?
I am.
Yeah, yeah. I think there would be a lot there that would set things up.
Yeah. One thing about the Romans, though, unless it was a super secret mission, which I think it was to North America, they always kept duplicate sets of records just because it's a smart thing to do. The Egyptians kept 5 sets, incidentally. And I believe that, well, I know that one of the officers from the 9th Legion, back to the 9th Legion for just a moment, It disappeared from history in 117 AD. There have been all kinds of speculation. They marched into Scotland and were never heard from again. They were disbanded and sent to the Netherlands, this and that and the other. But there is no clear historical reference for any of those claims. But there's one individual officer from the 9th Legion who does reappear in history in 142, and his name was Lucius Aemilius Carus, and he was appointed governor of Arabia Petraeus, what we call the city of Petra, you know, that natural toll booth in Lebanon or in Jordan where the Silk Road goes through. You saw it in one of the Indiana Jones movies.
Yeah, yep.
They called it the Half Moon Valley or whatever, but that was Petra. And he was appointed governor there when it became a Roman possession. And incidentally, they made a distinction between an empirical possession or empirical province and a senatorial province. And that one was an empirical province. So all of the tithe or tribute or tax that was collected there went to the emperor, not to the entire Roman treasury. Now, Carus, if he were in North America for the better part of 25 years, figuring out how to charge tithe, tax, tribute on the river systems in North America with all the fortresses that were here, then he could apply all those skills in Petra. In 1170, the Templars captured Petra. And they went excavating in that treasury and in a cave nearby that treasury. And 4 of them skedaddled back to England in a heartbeat with something. We don't know what. But I think it may have been that second set of records. And immediately after that, they started taking over Chaldee abbeys everywhere. Now, those that were associated with the old hierarchy of Britain. You know, Arthur's hierarchy. Mm. So there are some tenuous connections there.
Yeah, that... Everything sort of overlapping or starts to, if you dig a little deeper than, you know, what we're apparently told. You spoke of the Irish connection. You spoke of the Roman connection. Would you mind going to, you spoke of a few other people from other countries that artifacts had been found that you've come across, like the Chinese, for example. Would you mind going into that and just whatever else you can think of?
Sure, the Chinese connection is probably one of the strongest, and Gavin Menzies has done a lot of work and written a couple of, I don't know how many books now, about that connection, 1421, 1426, 1493, I believe. I don't know all these titles, but he has made strong connections of extant Chinese records describing North America and a 600-ship fleet. One of those ships was 480 feet long, manned by 2,500 people, and it was on the ocean for 3.5 years. And Fushang, what they called North America, according to him, and a lot of other people, is very well documented in the ancient Chinese chronicle. And 1421 was not the first time. They had one in about 1000 BC visit to North America. They described the Grand Canyon. They described bison. They described all these animals, the descriptions are very, very clear. And the sketches are pretty reminiscent of the extant populations of those animals. There were a number of artifacts found on the coast in Washington State and Oregon that are our Ming Dynasty artifacts. The archaeologists and historians say, oh, well, a ship just washed up there and dumped all that stuff because the ship broke up on that coast. well... Maybe by the thousands of ships, maybe, because there are a lot of artifacts. And when you find a Ming Dynasty vase in the ocean, you know, that's actually a very, very valuable piece of art. When you go to buy one and say you wanted to resell it to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for a single piece, if it's not fake. And sometimes when it is fake. But the extent of the evidence for Chinese goes into material culture as well as non-material culture. You have art by natives, in this case Mayans and Inca, that are much more than reminiscent of Chinese art. They are exact the same in style. You have Mayan stelae that depict elephants with mahouts on them. And the archaeologist, oh, no, yeah, you're misinterpreting it. It's a macaw. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a bird because it has that long beak. It's like that long trunk and that rider on its back with those huge ears. That's an Indian elephant. I'm sorry. Don't confuse the issue. And there are effigy mounds in Iowa and Wisconsin that show elephants. Jefferson, of living elephants, living mammoths and elephants in the western states. But it never went anywhere and we never found it. But the native traditions were strong enough that they conveyed it to the early politicians. You also have at Cahokia in southwestern Illinois, directly across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, Missouri, and the Great Gateway Arch. They are inside of each other. There were silkworm cocoons, and they're still in a museum over there. They're ignored by archaeology, but the museum curator thought they could be. So, silkworms? Well, yeah, we have mulberry trees here, so certainly possible. You have conquistador accounts of Native Americans wearing silks. How did that happen if they didn't have contact with Chinese? It was the most sought-after fabric in history, and in many cases still is. I like it much more than polyester. A
lot more better on the skin.
Yes, it is. Chinese, Irish, Welsh, Romans, Carthaginians. You have Carthaginian coins that are found in North America and South America. You have Greek and Roman amphora that are found along the coast of Brazil. Had 19 amphora found in the Bay of Forget where it was now. It may have been Sao Paulo, but seems like it was not. But there were a number of them. And they were, oh, no, some artist put that there to make it look old. Okay, fine. Then why did you cover up the site with 300,000 tons of sand? Because that's exactly what they did. You have sites in Bimini, in the Caribbean, where there are massive works, artificial walls and seawalls that are now covered by up to 30 feet of water. How long ago were they built that the sea level has risen that much? It's called the Bimini Road by many folks. But there are also anchors have been found there and on dry land in Florida that are very consistent with 3,000-year-old Phoenician anchors. You had a number of folks in South America, Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, who claimed to have found a lot of Phoenician artifacts. Well, the Phoenicians were sea traders, for sure, and I'm confident that, you know, that's only 700 miles or so of open ocean between the west coast of Africa and the east coast of South America. You know, a couple weeks at the most, even if you're just drifting, because that's the way the currents take you. That's how Columbus got here. Mm. So it's not hard to imagine that some seagoing peoples could have gotten here, whether it was on purpose or accidental, is kind of immaterial because the material culture got here. Okay, let's say a Nokia phone washes up on some Polynesian island that has never seen a phone before. Well, that's cool. I don't know what it is or what it does, but it looks really cool. I'm going to save that. And they did for generations and generations and generations. Or if it was something that was utilitarian in nature, say a knife of metal, particularly of a metal they've never seen before, particularly if that metal is a lot stronger than any metals or other materials that they've ever used, well, they're going to use it and be, you know, by comparison, superpower, I guess. So it probably got used up. But those art objects got saved. And you have statues of Hercules. You have later statues that are the same form, the same person, with different writing on it, because it now was adopted into that culture with a different writing system. But it's the same hero. You have, you have the Mi'kmaqs in Nova Scotia that have a number of cultural traits that appear to be derived from a connection with Scotland. Okay, that kind of makes sense. It's a long stretch, but you can sail it. And, oh, wait, they've done it in 3 weeks or less in a sailing ship, one-way trip. You have the Inuits. You have all of the native tribes of northern Canada and Alaska that have the exact same drums, clothes, hunting techniques, altars, songs. Yeah, some similar words with the Sami people of Scandinavia. And yet there doesn't appear to be any genetic connection. But they have all the same cultural aspects. I can't explain that other than to say, hey, they've been talking to each other. They even like the same music. So.
It's just interesting within itself. Have you found any connection with Egypt to America in any ancient things like coins or anything weird like that at all with an American-Egyptian connection?
Yes. Is it a verified? Well, it's kind of tenuous, but it's certainly, I guess, what would the right word be? It's compelling that I want to keep finding out more about it. There is this supposed cave 40 miles from me in that direction, 48 miles from me in that direction, near Olney, Illinois, called Burroughs Cave in most of the literature, where they found a lot of engraved stone. Yay big. They're black, creek rock with engravings on it. It looks like a caricature artist, and not a particularly good one in some cases, drew a lot of pictures of people, and he put little notes on it in a script that nobody can really read. But a lot of those figures appear to be dressed in Egyptian garb. Some of them are in Roman garb. Some of them are in Greek garb. But there are 7,000 of these things.
Jeez.
It's not like a guy doodled in his garage for a few weeks. and even at that, a caricature artist, 10 minutes and he's got it done. But he didn't have to make his own paper and pencil. Now, these stones come out of the creek kind of rough. But most of them are polished quite nicely. And I don't know, anybody out there who's ever tried to make a telescope mirror knows that you don't do that quickly. You expend tens, maybe hundreds of hours to get that surface quality that you want. Somebody did that before they even started writing on them, but there are 7,000 of these things. And supposedly there were also a lot of gold artifacts, smelted and poured gold, which is low temperature, so that's not hard. But the depictions on these things, you had, again, Asian elephants, so possibly a Carthaginian connection in there too, but they weren't the only culture that used elephants for war by any stretch. Charlemagne had a pet elephant, incidentally. Most people don't know that one. It came from India to France in 800 AD, most of the way by ship. You had, let's see, what else was in there? There were a lot of Phoenician, apparently Phoenician references and depictions, including one that most people would not figure out depicted the North Star, except that 2,600 years ago, we didn't use the same star as the North Star, and it's right on the stone.
That's weird. That kind of,
yeah. So Egyptian, yeah, there are a few connections. Of course, you got one in Queensland, too.
Yeah, well, in Australia, I actually had Stephen Strong on the show, who found a lot of trippy stuff with many other archaeologists and people that are researchers like yourself here. I had him on the show, and it was very educational, like having you on, in terms of finding out stuff that just the mainstream media and people don't cover. And it's totally changed not just my perception of our own history, even though I've had experiences that have done that, but also people like my father and others that I've spoken to and got them to look at some of this stuff because of the glyphs that were found here in Australia, even some of the gold that traces back to Tutankhamun's tomb, apparently, many other things. Have you had a Aboriginal connection to America at all that's been found?
You mean Australian Aboriginal?
Yeah.
I have not.
All right.
Yep. But, however, there are there's a culture that went dead in about 1500 BC in Central America, called the Olmec. And most people look at those big giant stone heads and they say, African. It's like, well, not necessarily. They could be Australian Aborigine. They could be, they could be from a half a dozen of the Polynesian islands. They could be Guam. They could be, you know, because it's not a matter of color. It's a matter of facial structure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is one tribe, it's more than a tribe, it's a genetic strain of West African that has this particular lip on the ridge on their lips,
mm-hmm.
that shows up in a lot of these stone heads. But it's not exclusive to that genetic strain. It also shows up in southwestern Australian Aborigines, as well as a few of the Polynesian and other Pacific Islanders. We also have strong evidence that Pacific Islanders and their chickens made it to Chile long before Columbus did. You had Easter Islander folks who had not just Polynesian genetics, they also had South American genetics. It's like they were sailing all over that giant ocean and knew where they were going.
Yeah. One of the things to think about is how they knew how to navigate and just things like that. They had to have had some knowledge. And when it comes down to what we're talking about and what you're researching and thoroughly in doing so is that there is advanced cultures that existed long before us and the mainstream mass don't know about it or cover it, though there are those interested, but it shows that we are smarter than what most think, and we have had technology and other forms of mathematics and astronomy and metalwork and everything else long ago rather than it just being a current thing.
Sure. As one example, and going back to the copper, you have all these experts that say, well, the copper age began in the southern Levant, in 5000 BC, or I should say the 5th millennium BC. And then you go to the ice core folks who go to Greenland, they pull up ice that's that age, and they say, oh, wait, no, yeah, somebody was smelting copper 500 years before that because it's in the ice core. You can't deny that.
Yeah.
You have, as another example, off the southern coast of Wales, there was a ship that they could only date it by style because all the wood was gone. They couldn't do carbon dating. But they found a shipwreck that had 290 copper bun ingots and 20 or 286 or something like that, copper ingots, and 28 tin ingots. And they said, oh, well, it was coming from the continent onto British Isles for trade. It's like, really? Where did they get tin on the continent? Because the tin was in Cornwall and the copper was in Michigan because it's highly pure copper. They, you know, how did they do that if they didn't get it from there? There was no reason to bring any of that stuff from the continent, from European continent into Wales. The ship was going the other way. That's my contention. And it's highly pure stuff. They had other artifacts on there. They had gold. Gold is harder to fingerprint than almost any of the other metals. The trace element analysis, for instance, of the Ulubran wreck off the coast of Turkey, which had about 10 tons of copper ingots, what they called oxide ingots, which, because it's shaped like an oxide. They traced almost all of that back to, the archaeologist said, well, it all came from one mine on Crete. And the metallurgist said, no, it didn't. It had to come, some of it had to come from other mines because it got a different fingerprint. Also on that ship were all these bolts of cobalt glass. Well, cobalt is something you extract from copper to refine it because it screws up your whole metallurgy process if it's still in there. And the way you pull it out of there is with sand that you use as a flux. Mm-hmm. Well, as one component of the flux. And that cobalt came from someplace not on Crete. It didn't come from Egypt either, although it was certainly used a lot in Egypt, and Egypt traded it all over its realm, which extended to India and beyond. The glass thing is important, and nobody's paying much attention to it. The flux thing is very important, too, because those minerals, sand is easy to find. Limestone is easy to find. But the exact right kinds to do the exact thing you want with that ore to clean it up are not that easy to find. You also had another mineral called fluorspar, which when you hit it, it glows in the dark. That's why they call it fluorspar. And it was mined in southern Illinois, not very far from where that cave is, incidentally. Was it used for that cobalt glass? I don't know, but I think if you did a serious metallurgical study, you might find out. I'm not capable of doing that. Some folks should.
Well, that's the thing with a lot of this is it's open for more investigation, and that's what it needs. Some of it you do need money in terms of scientific study or laboratories or whatnot, and you know there are people out there that help with that every now and then, and it's just something that really needs to be looked at, and sort of everyone sort of needs to network and help each other out, which I hope, you know, doing this type of thing does do. It gets the word out there and people come across each other and they can exchange information, research, evidence. But this is very, very important, and it goes back to show that humanity is a lot smarter than what we first think. You know, we think it's a recent thing. And that we've been around a lot longer and traveling and I guess even trading a lot longer on a worldwide scale, not just a local neighbourhood type thing. For quite a long time. So this is where this field of study totally intrigues me and interests me, and I'm always looking into this. And we've got to wrap up in a minute, and I'd love to have you back on sometime. Is there anything you'd like to quickly just go over, recent stuff going on or other shows, websites, videos, anything like that you'd like to get out there?
Sure. I have a lot of YouTube videos out there. Just do a search on my name on YouTube and you'll find me someplace.
I'll put the link up too.
Cafe. Yep. And this weekend, of course, it's Thanksgiving, our holiday in the United States this weekend, and I'm going to, of all things, a Star Trek convention.
Cool.
So I'll have fun with that, and I will have some books there, but I'm also promoting a couple of other endeavors I've got. AncientAmerica.com is a website I'm on most of the time. along with the Hollow Earth Insider, another topic we can talk about.
Yeah.
On a different show. And Ancient American Magazine. Archaeology of the Americas before Columbus, that's their tagline. ancientamerican.com with an N. Ancient America without the N is my website, mine and a couple other guys.
Yep. Now, well, I'll put a link to all that up there, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. We'll keep in contact, and anything sort of new in the pipeline or anything you'd like to touch on or anything you just want to share, just feel free to do so. I'll say there'll be a few emails coming your way after the show. There usually is to the people that are that appear on the show. But again, thank you very much for being on the show, and I'd love to have you back on soon. We'll keep in touch, mate.
I certainly hope so. Thank you, Peter.
Cheers, Rick. Bye, mate.
Bye.